Especially being a neurodivergent parent and then parenting neurodivergent children. It's a whole nother level.
Hester and Kelly Granger and their children are all neurodiverse.
Founded Perfectly Autistic, transforming workplaces through neuro-inclusive training, workshops and coaching.
Who was the first out of the four of you to join the neurodivergent club?
Well, officially joining it was Hudson. He had to have insoles put in his shoes, and I remember he was really, really screaming, and he was about three at the time. And the consultant said, I'm wondering if he's autistic. And then he said in the next breath, but he can't be because he's really affectionate with you and he makes really good eye contact.
Do you ever wish that your children were neurotypical?
I hate.
What would you tell a neurotypical struggling to understand a neurodivergent child who they see as misbehaving?
There is more to it than the misbehaving. What is the catalyst for it? And just try and work out what the difficulties are and what the triggers are as well.
Do you have any tips on how a parent can correct the behaviour of a neurodivergent child in a way that isn't going to make them feel like they're broken?
Yeah, 100%. I think...
Hester, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been diagnosed with ADHD. Your husband and two children have been diagnosed as ADHD and autistic. That's a lot of neurodiversity in one household. So what is the secret to keeping it functional?
That's a really good question. And you're right. It can be, you know, there's a lot of neurodiversity in our house. I think it's about not sweating the small stuff. I think it's about, you know, growing up, I was taught that you didn't put your elbows on the table, that you'd sit up straight, that you wouldn't fidget, which is ironic because that's all I ever do. But so then when I had the children, I was like, we'll sit down at the dinner table for dinner and we will all sit nicely and there'll be no elbows on the table, etc. And now when we eat dinner, my son, 9 times out of 10, will just be standing in the doorway because the smells in the kitchen might be a bit too much. Mm. He doesn't want to sit down. We've just discovered he doesn't actually like our dining chairs that we've had for like 2 years. He doesn't like the feel of it and he's only just told us. So that's why he won't often sit down. So I think the not sweating the small stuff is just quite pertinent in our family, really.
With the sort of new awareness that you've had since your diagnosis, can you look back in the past and see maybe mistakes that were made in parenting?
Yeah, I think so, 100%. I mean, I think you can, whether you're neurodivergent or not, you look back, especially now the children are 12 and 14, and so they are very vocal in a good way about, like, things they remember from when they were younger. So things like the times I sent my son into school when he was really distressed and upset, and I did stop that after a while, but, you know, they both had quite low attendance for quite a while from a school perspective, and I still really regret that, sending them in when they were really upset and things. Also just certain things I can remember, quite specific instances of like getting really cross about certain things. And I tend to give them a warning and I'm always like, I'm getting quite cross now. And it's almost passive aggressive. Like, I'm getting really quite cross. Mummy's going to lose it in a minute. And I kind of give them a few warnings and there are times and you just think, oh, but that's part of parenting. And I think you can't beat yourself up about it and you can't look back and go, oh, I did this wrong, I did that wrong, because it's just parenting and you're learning as you go. There's no manual. There's no, you know, especially being a neurodivergent parent and then parenting neurodivergent children. It's a whole nother level, I think.
So where did the journey begin? Who was the first out of the four of you to join the neurodivergent club?
Well, officially joining it was Hudson. And when he was growing up, he was a baby and I was trying to feed him and he loved bottle and milk and was absolutely fine. Then when I was trying to wean him, that just never happened. And I think now looking back, that was very much a sensory texture aspect. He would vomit a lot. He's got ARFID, which is avoidance restriction food intake disorder. So his diet, even now, he only eats bread with Nutella or Dairy, and that's breakfast, lunch and dinner every single day. And he'll only drink a few different drinks and he'll eat an Aero Mousse and a few, that's it. Actually, he's stopped Jaffa cakes now. So that's his entire diet and he's 12. And I think, you know, we sort of were sent to dietitians and sent to pediatrician and sort of like what's going on. And then someone mentioned, oh, maybe he's autistic. And I remember he had to have insoles put in his shoes and he had to go and have his foot almost like a sort of like a sand type consistency. And I remember he was really, really screaming and he was about three at the time. And the consultant said, oh, I'm wondering if he's autistic. And then he said in the next breath, oh, but he can't be because he's really affectionate with you and he makes really good eye contact. And like, that's the perception, isn't it? That if you're autistic, you can't make eye contact and you can't be affectionate. And then we didn't really think much else of it. And then eventually he was 7 and it kind of kept coming up and we were just like, well, let's just get him assessed and see where we're at. And then during that process, the psychologist would say, oh, does Hudson do this? And I was like, oh, no. And then I was like, but India does that. And I think we'd been so busy trying to sort Hudson out and his eating. We thought for a while he was celiac, so we had like tests done and we've had all these things. And we realised now he's autistic and it was anxiety. That's why he, you know, would have loads of stomach aches and stomach cramps and things, which is really common. There's a whole link with autism and gut anyway. But then during this process with India, it was like, but India does that. Hudson doesn't do that. India does that. And then we decided to get India assessed as well. But that took a bit longer. And they always said that Hudson presented like a girl. So he's very good at masking, which isn't a good thing at all, but masks a lot. And then India masks a lot as well. So at school, they just couldn't see it with India. They couldn't really see it with Hudson, but I pushed and pushed and we got some evidence from school. But with India, they couldn't at all. So it then took another 6 months after that for her to be diagnosed.
Mm. When they're masking as a parent and you're watching, can you tell when they're masking?
So it's really interesting because I always used to say, oh, like when they're out, they behave impeccably, which is almost what you want. You want the children to behave when they're out and they can, you know, to a point, behave how they want to at home. And we used to joke that India was allergic to our house. We would genuinely walk through the door and she would either, like I always say, kick off, which is a horrible term, but she's very vocal and would get very angry and quite shouty, whereas Hudson is much more, he cries. So in India, she doesn't do it so much at all because she's 14, but she knows how to handle herself a bit better and manage her situations and the things she puts herself through. But yeah, it was one of those where the masking, you would sort of not really be aware of it. And now you're like, oh my gosh. And even now I sort of saw the other day and I said to her, are you having a shutdown? And she was just like, yeah, she doesn't really have meltdowns. And she just shut down and she was just all too much. We were in a restaurant and she just was like, yeah. She said, I do this quite a lot. You don't realise. And it's like they just manage it so well, which makes me a bit sad that they've had to, but they found their own ways to cope. But yeah, masking's quite a big one even now, I think. But they've both said they don't know when they're doing it. They're not quite sure. India's like, I don't know. I just do things to fit in, or I'll watch what people say or watch what people wear or whatever. But I don't necessarily know I'm doing it consciously or unconsciously.
How do you think having ADHD has affected or influenced your parenting style?
I'd say I'm a fun mum. Like, quite genuinely, I would say, like, you know, the other day, India just ran, or no, about a month ago, India just was like, she's got a really limited diet. And she just was like, do you know what? I'm going to try KFC. And I literally went, let's go. Let's get in the car. Let's go. And I'm just quite impromptu. I think it's been quite tough looking back, not knowing I was neurodivergent as a parent. But in a way, it is what it is, isn't it? You don't really know. And I've only been diagnosed 3 years at 43. So the children, I'm really bad at maths, were like 9 and 11. So they've had sort of the majority of their younger years with me being undiagnosed. But I'm definitely quite chilled. I'm quite, even when they were growing up, we've never been massively into a routine with the children, whereas some people are like, this is the routine and this is what you need to do. But we tried to do a routine and we'd never stick to it because obviously we have ADHD. We didn't know.
It's fascinating. I'm thinking, so can you look back and see a distinction in terms of how you introspectively felt about yourself pre-diagnosis and post-diagnosis? And I mean, did you feel lost before diagnosis?
I have to say, this is the honest truth. I never, ever thought I was different. I never felt different. There wasn't a moment where I was like, oh, I'm acting like this and other people don't. So to be diagnosed at 43 was such genuinely a huge shock. And it was only because the children were diagnosed, because during lockdown we were homeschooling them, as obviously everybody was, and we were realizing that the processing just wasn't quite there, and that they just took a lot longer to process things. And we were like, maybe this is ADHD. And I'd been reading more about autism and ADHD, and then I was reading it going, oh my gosh, that's me, and I do this and I do that and I do this. And I think a lot of parents will probably relate to that. And now I've forgotten your question. It's very ADHD. What was it?
Before diagnosis, did you feel lost?
Yeah, no, because I just didn't know. So when they were like, it was during the children's assessment and the psychologist was like, so you've been diagnosed with ADHD? I was like, no. And she was like, oh. And I remember she was really surprised. And I was like, should I look into it? And she was like, yes. And I was just like, oh, right. But I think there's a really weird sort of almost twist in all of this, is that I've got scoliosis. So I've got curvature of the spine. I had it operated on when I was 11. I wore a back brace for 6 months. I've got a rod in my back and keep me straight or straighter. And so looking back, and even as an adult, sometimes if I think, if I don't move, I'm going to scream. I always put that down to my scoliosis. And I was talking to my son about this the other day, and I said, I wonder if I didn't have scoliosis, would I have noticed this like, oh my God, if I can't move, I'm going to scream in a minute, which I think is now more ADHD because I'm 11, you know, I had the operation when I was 11 and I'm now 46. So it's a long time ago. So I think I didn't, thankfully, I was, you know, a lot of women, I'm an ADHD coach and I coach a lot of women who are misdiagnosed with borderline personality disorder or bipolar, or, you know, they were very depressed or had sort of mental health issues. And I feel really fortunate that I didn't have any of that. So for me to be diagnosed was actually quite a shock, really. And it's sort of taken quite a lot to work through it and sort of, you know, understand myself a bit better.
Do you think you're an organized person?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Yes, because I think I've had to be unintentionally. So like friends, when I was first diagnosed, they were like, you can't have ADHD because you're like the first to reply on text. Because what's going to happen if I don't reply? Never going to reply again, am I? Like if I don't reply instantly and everything I do, like if I speak to my mum, she'll be like, oh, I just wondered if you can look into this for me. Oh, you don't need to do it straight away. And I'll be like, well, I do, because otherwise I just won't ever get it done. So I think on the outside, I look like I'm really organized. But I also think that I have to say that takes a lot of effort. So like to get here today, I left an extra hour early from what I should have done. So because I'm just so worried about being late. So I look like I'm really organized, but there's so much energy and so much effort that comes from that.
Yeah. Yes. So relatable. So relatable. I think I ask, because I heard you in a previous interview, you likened organizational skills to a swan, a calm exterior, but a lot of effort beneath the surface. And
yes.
I guess that's what you're talking about there. And for me, incredibly relatable.
Yeah.
You can turn up to an event, to a party, do a piece of work, but the chaos that can happen behind the scenes, which most people don't see.
No, this is it. And, you know, I'm a neurodiversity speaker. We do a lot of training. We do a lot of webinars. So there's sort of the feeling of letting people down. So the idea of, you know, being late on a train or that kind of thing, if I've, you know, been paid to go and speak at an event, the feeling is almost so overwhelming that I would just rather leave genuinely 2 hours earlier. You know, and it's also the whole sort of, you know, waiting mode activated, isn't it, with ADHD? That like you've got something to do and you're like, oh my gosh, like just started coaching two new people and they've both said, can they have morning appointments? Because otherwise they're like, I won't get any work done for the whole day because I'll just be in waiting mode.
Such a real thing, isn't it? That waiting mode. It's like it's that internalized anxiety about overthinking how it's going to go, desperately worrying about whether you're going to let someone down in the process.
Yeah.
You know, I was late today coming here, I think about an hour and a half, which is a new record. But the reality is, I turned up and we had a little joke about it, but for the last hour and a half, I've been a ball of anxiety on the train because I know I've got to come let you down, essentially. But it's a real thing. And it's that behind the scenes chaos.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the surface, we can look like our lives are together, but behind the scenes, it can be falling apart.
But don't you think there's a lot of social media that makes life look all very wonderful and very together, can't it? If you want it to, you can sort of put a lens or a filter on it, can't you? And be like, oh no, my life is, you know, this. And I think it's really important. I know you do that on your social media as well, is that like sharing, oh my gosh, actually this happened or that happened, because I think it makes it feel more real then.
Yes, definitely. You know, podcast going well, but I missed two flights in the last week to make it happen.
Yeah, but you would never know because you sit here and people go, oh, wow, that looks great. And I think that's the thing with ADHD is that it often looks like you've got it together. Like I remember when I was diagnosed, someone said, oh, but you can't have ADHD. Like I said, you're really organized. Are you sure it's not mum brain? I was just like, no, it's not mum brain. Like the kids are, I don't know what point mum brain stops, but then there's a perimenopause, which is a whole other topic of conversation. But that's like another element that then links into ADHD because it just exacerbates all the symptoms and all that kind of thing. And that's why a lot of women in my age, in their 40s, sort of late 30s and then early 50s, get diagnosed because they thought life was going fine. And that's how I feel, was just then the wheels got wobbly and then they fell off. And then you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of, you know, looking back, I think everything felt quite together. But then I think that's also because I now work with my husband. So I feel like I've been rumbled quite often. I feel like I can't not hide stuff, but like on the outside, it all looked quite serene. And that's not the case at all.
I've heard you talk about mum brain before and simply forgetting things. So I suppose, how can a parent or a mother tell the difference between mum brain and actual ADHD?
Well, I mean, to obviously be diagnosed with ADHD officially, you need to have had the symptoms before you were 12. Does that make sense? So I've always been like this. I've always spoken 100 miles an hour. I've always been on the go. I did every after school club there was going, and I would get very bored very quickly. I've done every evening class as an adult. I've done a hairdressing class. I've done an aromatherapy class. I've done, you know, Reiki, which my husband still teases me about now. Level one Reiki. But I decided it wasn't for me because you couldn't talk during the sessions. I was like, this is rubbish. So I think the mum brain would be then if it kicked in once you've obviously had your baby. Whereas if you've always been like this, that's the difference. And I think that's what I quite often stress. You know, there's a whole thing at the moment, isn't there? Oh, I might have ADHD as well. It's like, you know, and I'm quite practical, and like I said, we do a lot of training in it. It's that kind of like, but were the symptoms around before the age of 12, or is this something that more because life's got busier and life's more stressful, isn't it now? Is it more that, or is it mum brain, like we said, or is it actually ADHD? But I think, again, to be diagnosed with ADHD, it needs to negatively impact your life. So you can have all these traits, but if it doesn't negatively impact your life, that's okay. But I think it's when it does, that's when the problems can occur.
How many of those hobbies are still in your life?
Oh my God, none. I can't even express. There's a sewing machine still in the garage that my husband bought because I really wanted a sewing machine. And I genuinely made my daughter, like, her doll a sleeping bag. I mean, bearing in mind, I said she's 14. She's not played with those dolls for years. My husband's like, so how's that sewing machine working out for you? Love a jigsaw. Literally got so many jigsaws in boxes. Then I bought myself, because I'm this sad, a jigsaw, like, suitcase to put it in. But the overwhelming, you'll get this, the overwhelming thing of opening a new jigsaw, and I don't know how hard it's going to be. And then we've got dogs and kids and kittens, and like, so I don't know then where I'm going to do the jigsaw. So I can then think of so many excuses as to not do that. But yeah, so many, I've like a hobby graveyard.
Yeah.
100%.
I've got this shed, I nearly can't open the door actually. It's full of stuff that I've bought.
I now want to know, like, what though, please?
Yeah.
What kind of stuff?
Well, it's actually full of soundproof foaming because I originally started a podcast and I turned my bedroom into a soundproof studio, but then didn't want to do it anymore because I discovered ADHD and changed direction.
Yeah.
So it's basically full up with the old branding of that podcast, loads of soundproofed.
Yeah.
And two big dinghies.
Oh, okay.
Like inflatable dinghies that I bought from Lidl. Used them once.
The middle of Lidl is it's like an ADHD heaven.
Yeah, it's a trap, isn't it, for us? Yeah, you go in there for a banana, you come out with a barbecue.
I know. And I remember coming out once with like a balance bike for my son and being like, oh, here we go. Never used it as well, because they're like me. So that's the other thing as well. The kids are the same, and they'll have like a hobby or they'll have something, especially with the autism side of things as well. So my son loves to collect things. Loves a collection. And I remember when he was little, we'd be like, oh God, is that part of a collection? We'd be like, oh no, here we go again. And then literally this weekend, he's like to me, and he's not looked at his Match Attacks little football cards for years, but he's like, I can get rid of all of them. And I'm literally thinking, how much money was this? But it just is what it is, isn't it? And I think that's the thing, is not to beat yourself up about it and just go, that's okay. I tried those things and I didn't love it and I didn't stick to it. And, you know, something I have always stuck to is shopping. Love that. That's my go-to hobby. But I think rather than beating yourself up about it, I think it's just going, okay, that's just who I am, and I try new things and it may work. And now you know that, you then try not to spend a fortune. So with your dinghy, you then maybe hire one next time. Or, you know, like I keep seeing people like love a paddle board. It's like, don't buy one, just go and see how you get on with it. But that middle of Lidl is ADHD heaven.
Yeah, yeah. Lidl, yeah, for sure. They're very relatable, and I think a lot of people will relate to that. And it's good advice, isn't it, to not beat yourself up too much if you impulsively buy a painting set and then don't finish the...
I mean, I literally the other day, and I actually think they were from Aldi, was acrylic pens, because I saw you could draw on glass. Don't have any glass to draw. Don't know what to do with them. My daughter's like, oh, acrylic pens. I'm like, oh, yay. Don't know what they're going to sit with the other pens. Like the watercolour brush pens that also I don't do anything with. They're just a little, it's a whole thing at home.
I had a watercolour phase when I was a kid. I remember that.
See? Yeah, it's a whole thing.
Very relatable. Undiagnosed ADHD, what do you think the effect that can have on people's relationships and friendships?
I think it's huge. I think I know, looking back now, from a friendship perspective, I would either blurt things out, or like a very neurodivergent thing to do is you tell me a story and like I reciprocate with a story of a similar vein to show, oh, I understand. Oh, look at, but if you're neurotypical, you think, well, it's not about you. I'm telling you a story. Say, for example, a holiday. Oh, we went on holiday here. The ADHD urge is to go, oh my gosh, yeah, I went on holiday and oh my God, no way, my flight was cancelled or this is what happened or whatever. I'm not trying to make it about me. I'm trying to share that I understand. And I think from a neurodivergent point of view, you don't always understand that. And so friends are then like, okay, I've had friends say, it's not all about you. We're not trying to talk, you know, everything you talk about comes back to you. And I'm like, I don't mean to at all. And I'm not trying to make it all about me. I'm trying to show that I understand, because I think a lot of undiagnosed people are constantly misunderstood, or there's that fear, isn't there, if you say the wrong thing. So you send three messages rather than one because you're worried you'd be misunderstood or, you know, misread, or I'm aware I'm quite a lot, so I worry what people think about that. I try not to so much now. I'm aware I'm talking a lot now, but I don't apologise anymore. But it's that kind of thing, isn't it, where it's with friendships and then with relationships. Like I've been with my husband for years and years, so thankfully I've never had to online date and things like that, because we've been together for like 22 years and married for 17. And I just think relationships can be really, really tricky when you've got ADHD, whether you know it or not, because you're 100 miles an hour. I'm very intense. I'm quite needy from like an emotional, like my husband's like, I know you need a hug. It's all right. Come on then, kind of thing. But it's, that can be quite difficult as well in relationships.
Your husband, he is combined ADHD and also autistic.
Yeah.
How do you think it shows itself in him? And does that make your marriage challenging or stronger?
100% stronger. Like whenever I just talk about him, it's just like, oh, I'm quite soppy still after all these years. And I've known him since I was 15 and then we lost touch for years and got back in touch. And literally within 3 weeks of us dating, he asked me to go to Australia with him. And 3 months later, we were in Australia traveling, and we've genuinely not been apart since, pretty much. I think him being combined ADHD and I'm combined ADHD, I think a really good point to mention here is you can be hyperactive ADHD, you know, the combined, which is obviously inattentive and hyperactive. He's very internally hyperactive. So if you met him, he does not seem hyperactive. Whereas I'm very gesticulating, high word count, talk very fast. He's not, but you can still be hyperactive internally, where your brain doesn't ever switch off. It just never stops going. So I think from that point of view, we're really similar. The ADHD side, we're like, at the moment we're trying to book a holiday and we just keep getting carried away and the holiday's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then his autism side goes, this is ridiculous. This has got really out of hand. No. And then me and my daughter are like, like the ADHD side, we're then like, come on, like be fun sort of thing. But 100%, I think both being diagnosed, obviously Kelly was diagnosed autistic after the children were, I would send him information from the psychologist and he would reply, is that about Hudson or is that about me? I was like, it's about Hudson. He was like, well, that's what I do and that's how I feel. So I think from that point of view, it's been so useful understanding him and him understanding me. But thankfully, we've just always gotten really, really well. And then during his assessment, we had the same psychologist and I was answering questions on his behalf because that's literally what I do. And like the psychologist was like, is that Hester? And I just like popped my head around because it's on Zoom. And he was like, hi. And he just was like, it's just really good you found each other. And that just makes me laugh so much. Like, AKA, no one else would put up with either of you. Like, you just found each other and that's good.
so relatable. And I think when I impulsively book a holiday, I think that's the ADHD. I haven't got an autism diagnosis, but I strongly suspect it's there. And I'll turn up to the airport impulsively, having booked a holiday, but all my stuff will be in neat folders.
100%. Yes. So funny. And then also, I don't know if you do this thing, whereas Kelly, when we go to a hotel, he has to unpack everything and then hang it all up immediately. And I'm like, what is this about? Like, and then my daughter and I went on holiday together before Christmas, just the two of us, because that was meant to be like a 2-day trip to Germany to the German markets at Christmas that escalated us just into a 5-day trip to New York. I mean, we nailed that one. That was awesome. My husband was like, oh my God, Godspeed, kind of thing, you know, see you on the other side. And then we got to the hotel and she started unpacking everything and hanging it all up. And I was like, oh my God, it's like being on holiday with daddy. And she was just like, well, no, because I need it all in order. And that's the thing. It's the, Helly often describes the autism and the ADHD fighting each other. And on the one hand, loads of like impulsive and this, but then on the autism brain going, but then what happens if I do this? What are the ramifications? What happens with this? But then ADHD, come on, come on. Whereas I don't have that other side.
Is that battle between the ADHD brain and the autistic brain, do you see that in your family members? And do you struggle to understand it sometimes?
Yeah, I definitely see it. I don't necessarily struggle to understand it, but I'm very aware I'm not autistic. And so, like the three of them used to call themselves the A-team before I was diagnosed ADHD. So they were the A-team. And Hudson would be like, oh, mummy, you don't get it. You don't understand. And I'm really aware of that. Is like, I was in the car the other day with India and she was like, can you hear that noise? And I was like, no. She's like, I can literally hear the electricity. And then I went home and said to Hudson and Kelly, can you hear electricity? And they both were like, yeah, of course I can. Like, yeah. And I'm like, my God. So I'm well aware that, and their autism is very different for each of them. Like Hudson always says, he's really good at being autistic and India's really good at having ADHD. So I always think it's really nice because she's very ADHD led, but then does get really anxious and need things in order. But yeah, I just think it's hard with your autism and ADHD, but I can't really understand it because I'm just ADHD.
It's fascinating. I had a guest on, Jay Beach, and he's ADHD and autistic, and he described it as two sort of siblings that love each other but also hate each other.
That's sort such of a pulling good description. In
different directions sometimes.
Yeah. But I think we get carried away with things, so that's very much the ADHD side, because I then don't know when to stop, like holidays or getting giddy about certain things, and then all of a sudden the autistic side will come out and be like, actually, that's ridiculous. But we need that, because I think otherwise we just get completely carried away and run away with great ideas and things.
Relationships is a topic that comes up time and time again on this podcast, and you've been married for 22 years. What is the secret to a neurodivergent relationship?
I think the secret is, well, again, just to like not sweat the small stuff. So I remember like before Kelly's diagnosis, when he was diagnosed as autistic, I'd be like, oh, the bin's full. And I remember him being like, oh, is it? And I was thinking, why are you not emptying the bin? Like, I've said the bin's full. Whereas he's like, just ask me. So now I'm just like, please can you empty the bin? Yeah, sure. So I think if you hear us sometimes, I'd probably sound like I'm quite bossy, because it's like, please can you do this? Can you do that? But he's like, don't just allude to things. But yeah, I think the secret is just, and in it, as in any relationship, neurodivergent or not, I think it's just accepting each other for who they are, flaws and all and warts and all, etc. And also I just think about like respect. Like I just respect him so much. I think he's like such an amazing human. And I think what he does is absolutely brilliant. And the fact he can openly talk about being autistic, and he's 48 and, you know, diagnosed 4 years ago, and sharing his journey and things, I just think that's really huge. And I know it helps a lot of people. So I think, you know, having respect in a relationship as well, which I think sometimes you don't always get, like, you know, and I know some people that really moan about their husbands and things, and I'm just like, no, I just feel very grateful to have found him and for us to have found each other, because I think I don't quite know what life would be like if I hadn't found him, if that makes sense. That sounds really cheesy, but
no,
you know what I mean?
No, total sense. With that much neurodiversity under one roof, rejection sensitivity dysphoria, does that come into play?
I mean, what do you think? It's huge. Yeah, massively. Like, I know Hudson is very, very sensitive. I told him off for something earlier. I just went, Hudson, what was that? And then he was all mopey and sad. And I was like, I wasn't telling you off. I said, I just, you know, you need to understand X, Y, and Z. And I think partly because of what we do for work with Perfectly Autistic and the coaching and stuff like that, I think we talk about it a lot more than another neurodivergent family would, because we eat, sleep, breathe neurodiversity. So I was explaining to Hudson about rejection sensitive dysphoria, what that is. And he was like, oh my gosh, that's me. He said, you know, if a teacher would raise their voice or just go, Hudson, I would think, oh my gosh, the worst thing in the world has happened. So I think that's really interesting. I think it's really good to talk about these things that people know it's a thing. Do you know what I mean? Same when I'm coaching people, it's like, oh, I didn't know that was what it was called. I didn't know it had a name. I didn't know other people felt that way. And I think that's the really important thing, like this podcast, being able to talk about things, is then people go, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. So yeah, RSD is massive in our house, and trying to manage everybody's needs as well, because like I'm aware I'm a lot. I can't think what I was doing the other day, and India went, remember, I am autistic. Like, you're like, I can get really quite hyper. And she was like, remember. And I was like, God, I'm sorry. Like, I'll take it down a notch, because I just get really like quite excited.
It's such good advice. Just awareness is so powerful. Quite often on this podcast, and I've heard, you know, people trying to find solutions and techniques to manage RSD, and of course they're important, but actually just awareness sometimes, and to know that what you're feeling, there's a reason behind it. This can be really healing.
100%. And I also think knowing that that feeling will pass, rather than sometimes going, what can I do? What strategies can I put into place to get rid of this feeling? Actually, you know, you can kind of just distract yourself or do this or do that. But actually just knowing that this isn't going to feel like this forever, I think is really important, because I think sometimes there's this, we want to try and create solutions or find, oh, well, how can I fix that? And RSD, how, you know, I don't want to have these feelings. You know, I assume everyone listening knows what it is, but I don't know, obviously the real or perceived feeling of rejection, whether that's, you know, you can get an email from colleague at work or something like that, and it's just like, oh my God, they hate me. You know, I've had people who I've coached who were like, oh, I'm going to get sacked. And I'm like, well, why? Oh, because this happened. Okay, well, what happened there? And they break it all down, and I'm like, and do you think you're going to get fired? Do you think that's a sackable offence? Is that something they can sack you for? Well, no. And then it turns out it's not that at all. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? The ADHD overanalyzing very much comes into the RSD. But I think just being aware of it, knowing it's a thing, and knowing that that feeling will pass, I think is something we try and do as a family, especially.
Yeah. No, it's great. Really great. And I have to ask, do you have any tips to manage it when it does flare up with your clients?
I think it's about understanding, like, when the children were diagnosed autistic, I did every parenting course going, to the point where they were like, you need to stop and have a bit of a break and just sit with it. And I was taught to be a detective. So I think I apply this with my clients, is like, okay, well, be a detective. So you think you're going to get fired because of this happened. Okay, well, break that down. Talk me through it. What actually happened there? Okay. And then what I quite often do is I say, okay, if this was a colleague and they'd sent that email, what would happen? Do you think they'd get fired for that? And they quite often like, God, no, they wouldn't get fired for that, because that's not fair, or that's not a sackable offence, whatever it is. And then they're like, oh, and you almost see them, it dawning on them, are like, oh, okay, actually, I can see what you mean now. It's not, I'm not going to get fired for that. It's okay. And it's about breaking it down, because I think often it's quite an extreme feeling, isn't it? Or a friend's not WhatsApp me back, that's always a good one, or a partner or a new boyfriend or whoever, that like, oh my gosh, that's it, they want to dump me, they want to, I do it now. The other day I said to my husband, so are you angry with me? And it's like, no, oh, I'm literally just, we've had a conversation and now I've changed what I'm doing and I've moved on. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm quite often like, oh, I didn't think you liked me anymore. He's like, no, I still like you. We're fine. I think that's the thing.
Must be so nice to have that awareness within the family. Because like you said, you can just actually just voice your concern and say, do you like me anymore? And they'll probably know exactly what you're feeling and be able to reassure you quite quickly because of that awareness.
Yes, I think this is it. Exactly. And I think that's why it's so important to be able to share and to understand, whether you're diagnosed officially or self-diagnose, etc., is just to understand that, and also understand almost maybe the bits in relationships that you find difficult or you find challenging. And I think so often in, you know, especially new relationships, people kind of assume, oh, well, no, you know, my partner will know how I'm feeling, or they'll know this thought. And actually, I think sometimes you need to say, do you know what, this is how I feel, this is how I articulate things. Like, you know, so I quite often say to people, I'm high word count, I know what I'm like, etc., this is me, I like, take it or leave it kind of thing. And I think that's the thing, it's about having that awareness and understanding. But it is nice to be able to talk about it and to understand. And I think everything we do, that Kelly and I do, it's like, from a selfish perspective, like just trying to help our children. So when they go to the workplace, the world will know more about neurodiversity. From a family perspective, they'll understand more about themselves. We'll watch certain programs like Married at First Sight to talk about relationships and, oh, do you think that behavior was okay? What do you think about that? So like, I kind of hate the whole teachable moments, and my children are like, we know you're trying to teach us something, but I just I think I've just always parented like that, really. It's just who I am.
This might sound like a bit of a weird question, but I've spoken to other parents before. Is there ever do you ever wish that your children were neurotypical? And, or do you look at it as a superpower that's going to help them in the future?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I hate the word superpower. Like when you even said that word, I was like, oh gosh, I hate the word superpower because I've had that a lot. And like, oh my gosh, so what are their superpowers? Like I've literally had the questions like, can they sketch St. Paul's Cathedral? No. Oh my gosh, so they're like, they can play the piano without looking. I'm like, they're kind and funny. And my daughter's really good at spending our money. Like that's her superpower, is like shopping. Yeah. She's great at it. No, I don't wish that they were neurotypical because they wouldn't be who they are. But I really know that they find it really difficult sometimes because of the sensory processing, because of the, you know, just the challenges. Because, you know, if you're neurodivergent, it's really difficult whether you're at school or in the workplace, because I think there is still a lack of understanding and it's just not set up. The world is not neurodivergent friendly, is it? I was on the tube earlier and I'm not overly sensitive to noise. It was so loud I had to put my fingers in my ears because I just thought, I can't cope with this at the moment. And I think that's the trouble. The world is a lot for my children. And that just makes me a bit sad. But I wouldn't wish them to be neurotypical because that's not who they are and they wouldn't have their wonderful, amazing personalities. But life's tricky for them, 100%. And, you know, they're doing brilliantly at managing it and understanding themselves. But yeah, I think life's really hard for them at times.
Very excited to hear about your ADHD item, Hester. I think you said your ADHD item was a notebook. I'm going to pass this to you.
Yes.
And please explain why a notebook.
So, well, I was looking for a notebook and then they were all so nice, I actually didn't want to bring one in, which is so ridiculous because I've got so many and I don't use them. This is a organizer refill, so like old school file of facts. I own about 4 or 5 because they remind me of when I was little and it was really cool to have a file of facts. And as you can see, it's still in the cellophane. It is unopened. It's a to-do list to go in a file of facts. I have the file of facts. I've never used it. I have like 4, like I said. And I just think for me, this really is ADHD in a wrapper of a to-do list, because I think it's so easy, isn't it? When people are like, just write a to-do list. But then if you write a to-do list, I will forget to read the to-do list and I'll forget to tick things off, or I'll do it on my phone and I'll forget to look. So my item is literally, it says to-do list, organise a refill.
Yeah. Oh, so relatable, isn't it? How many do you have?
I mean, there was genuinely 5 different versions of this at home. We've got like a bookcase of notepads in the office, like seriously. And we genuinely have so many notepads because I like, they have to feel right. The paper has to feel good. I like a spiral bound, has to feel nice. The cover has to be quite dopamine seeking. This is not dopamine seeking, as you can see, but it goes obviously in a lovely file of facts. But I thought I need to bring this in because so many people don't know. And it's like, oh, you've got ADHD. Oh, just write a to-do list. It's like, doesn't work like that.
It's fun to write it, but then you'll probably forget to look at it.
Yes.
Well, that's certainly the story with me.
Yeah. You never look at it. Also as well, like if the book is then closed, that's it. So you're meant to like write them on like either a whiteboard, or we have whiteboards everywhere in our house, or like on a clipboard, because then you can see it. But then I also then forget to look at it. Even though it's right there, you just forget it's there. So this is my item.
Love it. Very relatable.
Is that okay?
Yeah, I'll take it home and put it with more of my unused notebooks.
You can add it to your collection. Yeah.
What do you think are the best bits of ADHD?
I think for me, I love talking to random people. I love meeting new people. And I often ask lots of questions unintentionally, not in like an interview mode, but I kind of often ask lots of questions. And I think I then find information out and I'm like, oh my God. And in my head, I'm like, that's why I got talking to you, or that's why I met you or spoke to you. And I just believe put good vibes out into the universe and good things come. And you say yes to things. And, you know, like, I just believe in not even manifesting, but just treating people with kindness and things. And I think for me, my ADHD side, like, my husband's really sweet and always says I've got the best bits of ADHD because I don't get massively anxious, apart from being late for things, but I'm not an overly anxious person. I don't get massively worried. And I just think for me, it gives me loads of ideas. It makes me really creative. I just kind of think it is who I am. Like, I feel quite intrinsically linked with my ADHD, and I don't quite know how I didn't know I had it before.
I have to ask, what do you think the worst bits of your ADHD are?
The overanalyzing stuff, the looking at things again and again and again. The hyperfocus can be really great, but also utterly exhausting. I think for me, probably one of the worst bits is either the procrastination of not like being able to get stuff done. And you're like, just talk about it for so long and it just doesn't work and doesn't work. And then I think with so many projects, I will do all the hard work. I'll do the really difficult bit. And the final bit is like sending an email or is, you know, just submitting that work or whatever it is. That's the bit that I can never do because the dopamine's gone. That's the boring bit, isn't it? So that's probably the hardest bit.
Would you sacrifice the good bits of ADHD to get rid of the bad bits?
No, I wouldn't, because I just think for me, like, I feel like I am ADHD, which sounds a bit much and a bit ridiculous, but like, I think for me, there's so many good bits. I have so many ideas and different things. I'm very high energy. So I'm like this all day, every day. And then my head hits the pillow and I'm literally asleep because I'm like this all the time. Do you know what I mean? But I think that's...
Yeah. It's everything about you, isn't it? You can't just pick the good bits, pick the bad bits.
No.
When it's well managed...
Yeah.
And you can mitigate the challenges.
Yes.
And lean into the strength.
Yeah. And I think the challenges for me aren't challenging enough to want to, like, get rid of that, if that makes sense.
I'm excited to pull out the washing machine of woes. Every week I ask my community for an ADHD struggle, and we'll call it a woe, and it goes in the washing machine of woes.
Okay. And we'll see. Alliteration.
Yes. It was my idea. Right. This week, the woe is... I can't hold down a job because I get bored. What do I do if I want to progress my career?
Okay, that's a very good question. Obviously, we don't know what their career is that they want to progress in, but I think, like, when we do training with organizations, it's all about finding that dopamine, finding the thing that brings you joy. So obviously, in every job, there are going to be parts of it that you don't enjoy. But I think if you work out what your strengths are, what you enjoy, what makes you happy, then find a career that matches that. I mean, I've had 30 different full-time jobs. Like, I've never been fired from any of them. I always have to caveat that. Never been fired from any of them. But I look back and think, gosh, actually, there was a lot of boredom involved. But I was in the media and then I worked in PR. So I think a lot of people in creative industries, I think that can work really well if you're quite analytical, obviously, sort of tech, IT, that kind of thing. But I think it's about finding the joy, but also finding a company and organization that gets you and that puts things in place to support you, because you can end up in any company, but if you're neurodivergent, whether you know it or not, if they're not going to put in the reasonable adjustments and the strategies and things in place, then it's not going to be a supportive environment for you anyway, even if it's the best job in the world.
I mean, do you think ADHD people currently have a tough time in the workplace?
Yes, massively. Yeah, that's what we do at Perfect Autistic, is we work with organisations and then work with the individuals as well to help them understand, like, the benefits that having a neurodivergent workforce can bring, like creativity, innovation, different ways of thinking. But also, I just think, like I said, you know, earlier, the workplace, especially the world, isn't always geared up to help and support neurodivergent people. And I think a lot of companies think that they are doing the right thing, or, oh, look, we put this policy in place or whatever, but actually they're not doing enough. And I think ADHD, if you've got ADHD and you're in the workplace, you know, like we were just talking about rejection sensitive dysphoria, there's so many things that managers and line managers can put into place to make that a bit easier. Executive function is a huge one. Like, you know, you can work with a I'm really bad at maths, but like a 25-year-old, but actually their executive function age will be like working with like about an 18-year-old because you're about sort of 30 to 40% behind. And the executive function, obviously, in the workplace is all to do with, you know, prioritization and organization and all these kind of things that we expect people to know, and people then progress in companies, but they don't, you don't ever get taught how to be a manager. I remember having to like line manage people, and I was like, I've never been taught how to do this. So I think having ADHD can be really difficult in the workplace.
Mm. Do you think RSD, rejection sensitivity dysphoria, crops up in that equation? Oh,
massively. We run a whole workshop just on that specific topic because it's so important. And I think people don't really realize it's a thing, and they just either think they've got a really sensitive colleague and they're like, God, I can't give Janice any feedback. And the, obviously the trouble is you're in a workplace, you need to be able to give feedback. You need to be able to explain to people what they need to do or whatever, but there are ways of doing it. And then I think that's why I said, when I coach people, I get people going, oh my God, I'm going to be fired. And actually when you pick out and unpick it all of what's actually happened, it's really, it's tiny, but because of the rejection sensory dysphoria, it's almost like a sort of big bad shadow that's behind you. It feels much bigger and much scarier. But when you break it down, it's like, actually, I think RSD at work is a huge challenge.
There's a couple of more woes. One of them says, what would you tell a neurotypical, struggling to understand a neurodivergent child who they see as misbehaving?
This makes me sad. That there is more to it than the misbehaving. That, you know, I don't know if this instance, I'm very detailed. So I don't know if this instance, if the neurotypical person knows that they are a neurodivergent child or if they just suspect it or whatever. But I just think it's about treating everyone with kindness, from children to adults in the workplace, from school. So I just think, quite often just thinking when the child's being naughty, actually there's, or, you know, if a child's been, inverted commas, disruptive, or, you know, the sort of the perception of sort of an ADHD naughty boy in the class, actually there's a reason maybe they're behaving in that way. And actually what is the catalyst for it? Because, you know, I remember when my children were little, even now having the right spoon is a very big deal. But it was like that would, you know, cause a meltdown, and we'd be like, where did that come from? It's not because I've given you the wrong spoon. What are the difficulties? What are the challenges? What's actually occurred ahead of that for that to be the catalyst? And, you know, the straw that broke the camel back, my daughter always says, the seagull that pushed you off the cliff, you know, what was that final moment? So I think for a neurotypical adult with a neurodivergent child, it's treat them with kindness and just try and work out what the difficulties are and what the triggers are as well.
When you do have to correct the behavior of a child, neurodiverse or not, but it will happen occasionally. Do you have any tips on how a parent can correct the behavior of a neurodivergent child in a way that isn't going to make them feel like they're broken?
Yeah, 100%. I think you can't not correct children, or otherwise you're just going to create monsters, and that's not fun. But it's about allowing. So it's about allowing for ADHD, or it's about allowing for autism. So, you know, when the children were younger, if one of them was having a meltdown, that's not the time to start saying, that's not how we behave, and can you not talk to me like that? But what you do is, when they've calmed down and after the moment, you then say, whether it's an hour or 2 hours later, do you understand why mummy was cross with that? Or do you understand why I wasn't that pleased with that? You know, do you understand? And I think it's the allowing for ADHD is huge, because it's, you know, you can't never not tell a child off, because obviously that's just crazy. But it's just about, again, looking at it with kindness and understanding what the catalysts are. There might not be, they might just be having a bad day, or there's, you know, throw puberty in the mix and some hormones and all that kind of thing. It's a roller coaster. And especially with my two, I sometimes try to unpick, is it just that we've got a 14-year-old teenage girl? Is it that she's autistic and ADHD? Is it that she's PDA? Like, where are we at with this? And you don't always get it right. But I think, like I said, it's that whole kindness lens, I think, is really important.
Got a final woe.
Yes.
And it says, there's a high divorce rate in neurodiverse relationships. Where do you think they might be going wrong?
Well, I think if you're undiagnosed neurodivergent, then you don't always know, you don't always recognise how you behave. For example, a lot of autistic men are quite often described as sort of narcissistic behaviour. And actually, they're not narcissistic at all. They might be come across as quite blunt or to the point. Or, you know, inverted commas, they might be seen as self-centered, and actually that's not the case at all. They're autistic and they're trying to manage their needs. I think there is, apparently, I don't know the stats, but there is a high divorce rate amongst neurodivergent people. And I also think it's because they don't always necessarily understand themselves. You know, I'm aware I'm a lot to put up with. I always say that. I know sometimes people say, oh God, you must put up a lot with your husband being autistic and ADHD. I genuinely think he puts up with a lot more of me than I do of him. because I am quite high energy. And again, that's not for everybody. And I think the miscommunication can be massive as well. And I think it's if you're not aware of that, you might wonder, well, you know, I said this. Well, no, you didn't. I said that. Well, did you? And it's that, again, being able to talk about it and understand, actually, you know, it's not a blame game. Let's try and unpick it here, and there's no right or wrong, but try and work through it.
Do you think it's hard for a neurotypical to understand the emotional dysregulation side of the ADHD partner if that combination was there?
Yeah, 100%, because it's a bit like I don't understand what it's like to be autistic because I'm not autistic. So, you know, if you are neurotypical and you're trying to understand emotional dysregulation, that's like a whole nother level. And you just might think, gosh, where did that come from? And everyone's got their challenges and everyone's got their difficulties. But I think it is really, really difficult, quite genuinely, for neurotypical partners to understand. And also, I think as well, there's almost, if you're an adult who's being diagnosed, there's almost like that pre and post diagnosis. And then you get quite a lot of neurodivergent adults that go, actually, do you know what? There's a bit more to me than this. Or actually, I've always been tried to be people pleasing is a huge one, comes up a lot, you know. Actually, I've always tried to fit in. I've tried to do this, and actually, I don't need to now because I'm unmasking and I am who I am. And I think that probably happens quite a lot, which then may not work with the neurotypical partner.
Have you got three tips for being in a relationship with an ADHDer?
Yes, I think try and be as kind and understanding as possible. As you can tell, kindness comes up a lot, but that kind of like understanding that they're not always, not trying to be who they are, but almost like just letting them be who they are. Does that make sense? So appreciating that the mask may be off, and obviously if you're their safe person and that's who you feel comfortable with, they are going to maybe behave differently than they would with someone else, which might be quite difficult. There's a really great couple on YouTube called Tara and Barry who are amazing.
Yeah, I know.
Who are really, really good and really great at sort of explaining more about that. But I think being kind and kind of understanding that they might behave differently to you than someone else. I think, like I said at the beginning with the family, but with the partners, don't sweat the small stuff. So, you know, my husband literally goes around after me when I've been like cooking or like making a sandwich because it's just carnage in the kitchen. And he just, bless him, quietly puts it away and goes, did you want to put that ham in the fridge? Oh yeah, please, I forgot. You know, so I think it's about the not sweating the small stuff. And also I think enjoy it. Like there's a reason that you're attracted to that partner. There is a reason you're attracted to that person. And partly that will be the ADHD side of things. So enjoy the spontaneity and all the goodness that it brings with the creativity and the innovation and like the fun side of things as well.
Yeah, so true, isn't it? I think some of the aspects that might make it challenging is probably also the same aspects that are going to make them great and the reason you fell in love with them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Got a bit of a closing tradition on the podcast, Hester, and that is to ask the question, what's the most impulsive thing you've ever done?
Done quite a lot of really impulsive things. I think like, my husband and I, when he was my boyfriend at the time, went to Reading for the day. We lived in London at the time and we bought a flat, which sounds like...
On the day?
Genuinely on the day. We'd never been to Reading before. We had a really nice lunch down by the river and we thought, oh my God, this is really nice. And then we went to view a new build apartment because that was what we did for fun. And we were like, oh my God, let's live here. And the backstory is we'd got a mortgage in place because we bought somewhere in London and that had all fallen through, but we weren't about to buy anywhere. And we had to go to Tesco's years ago. And they were like, she was like, oh, did you bring your checkbook? And I was like, no. So we had to go to Tesco's and get as much money out as we could in our overdrafts on different cards to go and put like £1,000 down. And then I remember getting in the car and going, oh my God, we just bought a flat and we moved to Reading. So that's fairly impulsive.
How long were you there for?
We were in the flat for 18 months before I got bored and realised for that same price we could have had a house. We've moved quite a lot. But that's the thing, is the egging each other on thing. But someone else will go, this is ridiculous. Never been to Reading. You don't know what it's like. But we were like, oh, it's only 25 minutes from London. It's fine. We can still work in London, etc. But yeah, I just love being impulsive. Like, even talking about it, I just get a dopamine hit of like, love it. But yeah, I'd say that's probably the biggest impulsive thing.
Hester, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.